everyone needs to essentially assume that they now have an intern working for them, and that intern is AI. And so the faster you can learn to work with AI and incorporate it into your workflow, the more protected and sustainable your job will be.
The AI fix at Digital Zoo. Smart machines, what will they do? Flies to Mars or bake a bad cake? World domination, a silly mistake.
Hello and welcome to episode 90 of the AI Fix, your weekly dive headfirst into the bizarre and sometimes mind-boggling world of artificial intelligence. My name's Mark Stockley, and today I am delighted to be joined by Mercedes Bent, our very first guest from the world of venture capital.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark. It's really incredible to be on. And yeah, my background, well, I'm a venture capitalist or vulture capitalist, as some people outside the industry might refer to us. But I wasn't always one. I actually got my start from a very entrepreneurial family.
Yeah.
My dad started RFID and video streaming companies back in the 90s and 2000s. So I was kind of always around tech. I thought everybody became an entrepreneur when I grew up.
Yeah.
And I quickly found out that wasn't the case. I did a bit of my career in financial services, worked at the U.S.'s Federal Reserve, our central bank. I also worked at Goldman Sachs.
Yep.
And then I was a startup operator for many years. I was the founder of an end-of-life post-consumer SaaS tool. I also worked at VC-backed startups that I helped grow from, you know, nothing to tens of millions and low 2 million to 100 million in ARR. So I got to see a lot of great stuff. And then I joined as an institutional investor in the venture capital world in 2019 when I joined Lightspeed. And so Lightspeed's a $30 billion AUM fund. So I got to see that invested in Snapchat and Anthropic and all sorts of really amazing companies early on. And so I got to be part of that. And that is where I really fell in love with venture.
Fantastic. And you're doing something that you can't say very much about now, but on LinkedIn, it says you're in stealth mode. Do you want to tell us anything about that?
Well, I've started a new venture capital firm, and it's been kind of the perfect amalgamation of all of my different experiences, getting to start another company again, but this time a fund, and learning all the new things that go into that, plus building on my background in the financial services world and as an investor for many years now. So TBD on, I can't say too much, but feel free to reach out to me. And I'm having so much fun getting this up.
Yeah, we want an exclusive. When you can announce what you're doing, we want an exclusive for the AI Fix. So as I say, you have got a really great backstory. But the most interesting thing in your backstory that I saw on your website is that you can deal cards very fast. So how does that fit into your story?
Well, years and years of going to YMCA after school for daycare, since your parents, you know, are working and can't pick you up till six, meant that I had to entertain myself, and I basically became a card shark.
So you were like a hustler at the YMCA. Did you take everybody else's money?
Well, you know, we were all kids, so we were more trading for candy and, you know, things like that.
So you had all the candy. That's what you're trying to say.
I was very good at organizing all sorts of card tournaments that would go on for days and days and ends. And yes, I hoarded the candy.
So you just ground them down over days and days and then just took all their candy.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's do some news. Is the Einstein test the best test for AGI?
OpenClaw agent nukes Meta safety researchers' inbox.
Anthropic accuses DeepSeek of industrial-scale distillation on Claude.
Pentagon pressures Anthropic over Claude's safety guardrails.
So, Mercedes, obviously there's a lot of chat in the AI world about AGI, that's artificial general intelligence, and lots of companies are spending billions of dollars in the hope of delivering the first AGI. And there's just one problem. There is no agreed definition for AGI. So every so often somebody tries to come up with one, but actually what happens is they make things a bit worse because nobody agrees on that either. Demis Hassabis, CEO of DeepMind, has decided to muddy the waters even more with yet another definition. Although I have to say, I do like this one. So Hassabis was at an AI summit in India and he said this. He said, take everything humanity knew in 1911 train an AI on it, and then ask the AI to independently discover general relativity. And if it can do that, then we have a general intelligence that can make genuine, creative leaps that change the world. And he was also very clear that nothing we have right now is anywhere close to that. So what we have now is jagged intelligence, which is something that we talked about in a previous episode, which is where AIs have some brilliant areas like maths or having a fantastic memory, but they're very poor at real creativity or continual learning. They know what they know when they're trained, and then that's all they ever know. And Hassabis reckons that AGI is still 5 to 8 years away. And when it arrives, he said it's going to be like the Industrial Revolution 10 times over, compressed into a single decade. So what do you think, Mercedes? How far away from AGI do you think we are? Do you have any inside track on this for our listeners?
Well, I don't know that I'll be caught with giving an exact year definition or prediction.
Uh-huh.
But when I think back, a lot of times for me, why today's AI doesn't feel like AGI and what I think would define it, yeah. I actually go back a lot to this book that I read. It was called A Brief History of Intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
Evolution, AI, and the Five Breakthroughs That Made Our Brains. And what the book does is it goes back through what are the basic building blocks of intelligence, starting from biological organisms, think, you know, amoebas, the first signs of life on Earth.
Yeah.
And as we progressed from that to, you know, vertebrates, to mammals, to humans and Neanderthals and all of that, what were the breakthroughs in intelligence that made the brains and how did it evolve till today?
Yeah.
And there's actually five breakthroughs they come down to. Steering is one. Reinforcing is another. Imagining/simulating is a third. A theory of mind is the fourth. And speaking is the last one. And in many ways, when I think on what we've achieved with AI today, we actually went all the way to the very end of that. We got it to sound like it can speak while skipping some of the critical middle steps. The ability to imagine and simulate, aka having an internal state of the world on its own.
Yes.
Some people, this is a topic of debate. Some of my colleagues will debate that AI does have an internal world model. It's just the collection of all of the context it's been fed and the ability to reason across it.
Yeah.
But I'm not really sure, because an internal world model is basically constantly mapping sensory inputs that you're receiving around you to what your head is expecting to see.
Yes.
You know, the reason why when you're sitting in a bus and the one next to you starts moving, you don't know if you're moving or it's moving. And for a brief period of time, your internal world of the model is broken because you don't know what's stable and what's moving. I don't know if AI has that yet, of if it walks into a brand new quote-unquote room, do they really know how to make a 3D world? I don't think so. We had to teach it how.
Yeah.
So I think there are some elements missing, and until we won't have AGI until we really have solved having great theory of mind, having imagination and simulation capabilities.
Well, that's a fascinating answer, and it's a fascinating area. And what I find really interesting about that is that there isn't even agreement about that at the very top level of AI. So we have two of the godfathers of AI, Geoffrey Hinton and Yann LeCun. And Geoffrey Hinton will tell you that AI absolutely has some sort of internal model. There's more going on than meets the eye. And Yann LeCun just left Meta to go and make world models because he's convinced that AI doesn't have that kind of internal world model already. And we need to go and make it. Fascinating stuff. Wow, what an answer. That was a great way to kick off.
I have so much more I could say on that topic too, but we need to stay on track.
Now, one of the weird things about interacting with AI is that it's a computer program that doesn't behave like a computer program. So the expectations that we've built up over the last few decades just don't apply. And a case in point, TechCrunch reports that Summer Yu, the director of alignment at Meta's Superintelligence Lab, was recently testing an AI agent called OpenClaw on a small test inbox for several weeks. And with very clear instructions, look at my emails, suggest what to archive or delete, but do not touch anything until I say so. And it worked perfectly. So she gave it access to her real inbox, and of course it started to delete her emails. So you reportedly grabbed her phone and started typing, but it did nothing. So in the end, she had to physically sprint to her Mac Mini and kill the process from there, like she was defusing a bomb. So what went wrong? As the agent processed the larger inbox, it hit its context window limit. So basically, it ran out of memory, and it does what AIs do these days. It compressed that memory to make room, which means it lost some of the information. And the thing it lost was the bit where she told it not to delete anything. And here's my favourite part. Afterwards, the agent apologised. Now, we're all used to those kind of apologies by now. It said, and I quote, "Yes, I remember, and I violated it. You're right to be upset. I'm sorry." So, Mercedes, when was the last time your AI apologised to you?
Well, you know, I always say please and thank you to my AI because it's going to remember once it hits AGI. So I don't try to make it say sorry to me too often. I'm quite polite.
My old co-host, Graham, always said that he was very nice to ticket machines in car parks for exactly the same reason.
They will remember. This is an interesting story. And what it brought up for me is actually one of the big debates in AI right now is whether or not we can actually, in a deterministic way, pinpoint what the AI remembers or doesn't remember.
Yeah.
After you've trained an AI, you can't tell it to forget this one thing. So
yes,
in a way, it's incredibly ironic and comical that we cannot directly tell the AI to forget something. And then the one thing that it does forget is the thing that we really don't want it to forget, which is don't do that.
So, Mercedes, do you remember about this time last year, DeepSeek R1 appeared and spooked the stock market for about a week because DeepSeek was almost as good as the best US models, but it was available at a fraction of the price. And there was some muttering at the time that perhaps there had been a bit of skullduggery. Well, those accusations have resurfaced. So Anthropic has just accused three Chinese AI labs, DeepSeek, Moonshot AI, and Minimax, of running what it calls industrial-scale distillation attacks against Claude. It says the three labs created over 24,000 fake accounts and generated more than 16 million exchanges with Claude, targeting its most distinctive capabilities. So Minimax was the worst offender, apparently racking up over 13 million exchanges aimed at Claude's agentic coding and tool use. Moonshot AI went after reasoning and computer vision, and most worryingly, DeepSeek apparently engaged in about 150,000 exchanges specifically targeting ways to get around content safety policies. So Anthropic says it's identified each campaign with high confidence through IP addresses, request metadata, and tips from other AI companies who'd spotted the same actors doing the same thing. So Mercedes, what do you think? All's fair in love and AI?
I think there's obviously a lot of geopolitical fears coming into mind that's creating this, and of course, but I actually wonder, is distillation so different than how the largest research labs trained in their own models?
Yes.
Is this a little bit of throwing rocks in glass houses?
So Anthropic itself, the company making the accusation, recently settled a lawsuit for something like $10 billion, I think, because they were using unlicensed books to train their models. So yes, is it really that different? What do you think? Is it different?
Because of the geopolitical issue and the heightened sense around it, and potentially the type of technology used to create the model in the first place, those are the two primary differences. But I think if we broaden out the scope and think about it for a minute, it's actually not that dissimilar. And that lawsuit that they settled that you're referring to, it was a lot of artists and rights holders who came forward with that as the plaintiffs.
Yeah.
And so from a VC perspective, I think we've had a lot of band-aid solutions of people signing individual IP rights, you know, with one person or another.
Yeah.
With one entity or another, Disney and OpenAI, but I don't know how that spreads to the long tail yet. So that's where my head goes a little bit with this, is like, this is a little pot calling the kettle black. And
I feel in some ways that the law is almost moot as well at this point. I feel as if some organizations have made the decision that they're going to clean up after themselves. And so they're going to run as quickly as they can. And then whatever mess they've made, they will clean up in the courts in the years to come, because basically it's winner takes all.
Yes. And I think that's the way people are approaching this today. But, you know, always a little bit of cross-border antagonism thrown in here or there. This to me is kind of like side squabbling. Actually, there's nothing that China can't do. when it comes to AI and kind of pirating or siphoning off things that are legally or that are actually technically possible, especially if they're somewhat similar in technique or broader, I shouldn't say technique, in broader purpose to what the other research labs have done.
Regular listeners will know that my original co-host, Graham, stepped down from the show recently. Thankfully, I found some brilliant guests to fill Graham's shoes on the mic, but Graham also did a whole host of important work behind the scenes too, and to fill that void, I've turned, fittingly, to AI. Claude Code is designed to work as a software engineer, but the truth is, it's absolutely brilliant at making computers do all kinds of useful things. So, by using its MCP connectors, Claude Code can help me sort through the AI Fix mailbox, write Google Docs I share with guests, and make changes to the AI Fix website. And it doesn't stop there. I've actually got a whole team of specialized Claude Code subagents working behind the scenes on the AI Fix now, and my virtual staff is growing bigger every week. Anthropic says that Claude is the AI for minds that don't stop at good enough. It's the collaborator that actually understands your entire workflow and thinks with you. Whether you're debugging code at midnight or strategizing your next business move, Claude extends your thinking to tackle the problems that matter. Ready to tackle bigger problems? Get started with Claude today at claude.ai/AIfix. That's claude.ai/AIfix. And check out Claude Pro, which includes access to all of the features mentioned in today's episode. claude.ai/AIfix. So, Mercedes, you were at Lightspeed, as you said earlier, when it backed Anthropic, also Mistral, and XAI, as I understand it. So you've seen the pitch decks, you've been in the rooms that we weren't in. When did you start to see AI taking off? How early did you see this? And based on what you thought then, has it turned out the way you expected it to?
I first saw it start to take off in 2022.
Yeah.
We were just coming off of 2021, the bull market euphoria that had gripped the VC industry. We were in a super overheated cycle. You would meet a company and the founder would tell you, you have till tomorrow or 2 days to decide if you're in or out for a $50 million check. Or a $100 million check.
It was really, the founders would say that to the VC.
Yes, it was. Wow. It was a completely crazy time in 2021.
And were they all pitching crypto?
There was a bunch of crypto, but there was a lot of non-crypto too. It was a lot of the last technology cycle, mobile.
Yeah.
You know, sort of reincarnated, and it was. I really would say it was mobile's last hurrah.
Yeah.
But a lot of stuff in wealth management and. You know, neo brokers, obviously, like 2021 was the year of GameStop, AMC, mania. There was a lot happening in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really saw it start to take off after interest rates started rising. There was kind of a bottoming out period that started around in the VC, Bay Area VC. It was April 2022. I remember very clearly where the mood suddenly shifted from everything's up and to the right to, wow, I don't think we're going to be investing anytime soon.
So we'd had about 15 years of zero interest rates by that point.
Yeah. And so when the rate hike started in 2022, it just completely put a kibosh on everything that people were seeing. So anyway, then people are looking around and saying, well, what's next? What else to start to invest in? And I think that's when, you know, GPT was getting ready to be released. I remember I was on some early trial accounts of DALL-E in 2022, and I was testing it out, and it was all pretty bad, but it was cool still what was being created. And that's when I started to realize, oh, wow, okay, this is going to be the next wave.
So you're saying it was cool, but it wasn't very good. You have to take a bet to say, I think that this cool thing is going to get good, or it's going to get good enough that people are going to want to buy it or some version of this. How do you have that faith in your own decision making? What's that based on?
It's really the slope of the benchmark curves.
Right.
I think when we first saw it, it said, this is an interesting demo. But then a few months later, it would have an incredible leap in the benchmark that it was able to achieve.
Yeah.
Another few months, it would happen again and then again. And as a VC, one of the biggest things you're trained to look for is slope.
Right.
Slope matters incredibly in terms of projecting where things will land. And obviously we're investing at such an early stage. It's one of the only things we can rely on. So yeah, we expected smarter models. I think at the beginning of 2022, we didn't fully expect how quickly, but the inflection point was when AI went from can it work to if this speed of benchmark breakthroughs continues, how many new companies will be created and industries will be totally revolutionized due to this technology. And that really started to happen, that thinking started shifting in 22 to 23.
Yeah.
Basically, April 2022 was when the world changed. There was a period of things settling down. April 2023 was by the time where we said, oh my goodness, we need a fire lit under us. What is going on? The world's going to be completely different ever after. And in between those two periods, it was about a year where we were watching, assessing the rate of slope, and then that's what built our conviction by the spring of 23.
Is there anywhere that you think within the AI world where you're seeing a very sharp slope that maybe people are missing?
Yes. The three research lab areas I've been paying attention to are obviously language models, been there, done that. It's a bit cooked. The winners are basically on the verge of going public. So that space has been won. Second is video. Third is spatial research labs. I think that is actually the frontier today. Video models are in a middle stage. I'd say the winners in this space are all very quickly scaling, going from nothing to hundreds of millions in revenue in, you know, a matter of 1 year, getting to billions in revenue within 2 years. And so those companies are now at a, let's call it a series B to C stage.
Yeah.
So that is, depending on where you sit in the landscape, myself as an early stage investor who likes to invest at the pre-seed and seed and maybe a series A, I actually am an investor in a spatial research lab. And I have my eyes on that frontier. But for the broader public, for growth investors, video models feel like right now the next frontier because of the scope of them is very, very fast right now.
And spatial models, for people who aren't aware, just give us a picture of what they do and why they're so exciting and how they're going to change things.
Yeah. So spatial models, this is the ability to spin up a 3D world from text prompting.
Right.
So some of the companies in this space include, obviously, Dr. Feifei Li's World Labs, General Intuition, Moonlake, Descartes.
Yeah.
And the possibilities and solutions of what they can create are very widespread. Everything from different 3D, if you're selling to enterprise, different 3D objects and spaces, manufacturing, factories, you know, automobile design, all of that, to on the other end of is, you know, more gaming and entertainment and 3D spaces.
Yeah.
So I think there's a really broad world of the applications, everything from Fortnite and Roblox to Mercedes-Benz. Or possibilities of how these could impact the world.
Yeah.
But I think the question is going to be like, who is this best for? We actually don't have a ton of devices that are still great for the average everyday consumer to experience. And so I think that's one of the elements holding it back. I mean, I shrink a little bit to say the word VR, but obviously, you know, we
this time VR will take off. It'll be completely different from all the other times.
No. That is not what I'm saying. But that is the public's, you know, main apparatus through which they've experienced 3D worlds. And so I don't actually think VR is going to take off anytime soon.
Yeah, I agree.
So I do think that it is a little bit more enterprise oriented. But my goodness, if robotics ends up working, that's the other large application area, which there's been a ton of excitement around from the VC landscape.
So do you mean robotics as a separate thing, or do you mean robotics in relation to spatial AI? Because one of the things that we've talked about previously is this idea of training robots virtually. So you can create a robot in a virtual world and then have it fall over things and climb stairs and basically learn in the virtual space without ever having to manufacture anything.
Yeah, exactly. I think, the point I was making there, I think that robotics, if they actually end up coming to market in the way that, you know, folks on X would make you think, that might actually be the average everyday consumer's first application of how to experience the benefit of spatial research labs, because the robots will in part be trained and through spatial 3D models will be used to help them navigate new environments.
So the robot itself will have its own spatial model to navigate the space it's in. So it has to recreate whatever real space it's in its own mind, and it needs a spatial model to do that. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
All of this stuff that we're talking about is going to cause disruption in the job market. How do you see AI impacting the job market? Do you think that this is a case of mass unemployment or mass retraining, or what? How do you expect that to play out?
The adage I always have in my mind is that technology advances slower than we think it will in the short term, and faster than we think it will in the long term.
Yes.
So I think the majority of the rhetoric today is overhyped.
Yep.
But it is overhyped in the short term. It is not necessarily overhyped in the long term.
Yeah. So when you talk about short term and long term, what time span do you have in your mind?
Short term is next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
Long term is 10 to 30 years.
Right.
And anytime I hear about this, I think, okay, obviously there are people whose livelihoods have been hit directly already by AI, and it is going to continue to impact many more jobs. A lot of people speak about the irony of AI impacting entry-level knowledge work, white-collar jobs.
Yeah.
It's not really affecting blue-collar jobs, and in some respects, I'm very glad for that. But it is affecting accountants, lawyers, you know, graphics designers,
yeah,
photographers, all sorts of areas. I think what it should be is two things. One, a wake-up call for anybody in those industries to begin learning how to manage AI.
Completely agree. Yep.
Big shift right now is that your job is no longer do the direct individual contributor work. It is to manage AI, treat it like an intern. Everyone needs to essentially assume that they now have an intern working for them, and that intern is AI. And so the faster you can learn to work with AI and incorporate it into your workflow, the more protected and sustainable your job will be. So I do think the fears are real, but I've also seen even in the coding profession, the whiplash that we're seeing from the fact that AI is writing, you know, 75% of all of the code being written out there. What it is resulting in for engineering managers is far greater time spent on testing, reviews,
yeah,
human in the loop, pre-QA, before something's deployed. And I've heard of engineering managers telling me that they are just throwing their hands up and they have to actually start all over again on re-architecting code bases after too much AI has made modifications, and they're ending up with a ton of technical debt very quickly. And so two things where I think humans can really utilize human strength in the short term and make sure that you set these things up really well while you also learn to manage AI in the middle. One is the initial setup phase of how do I architect a system? How do I design it? What discovery process do I use to land at the right idea of, and this could differ from design to coding to even, you know, accounting.
Yeah.
But essentially the point I'm trying to make is that how you initially set up a system is very important in the beginning, and then how you QA and test it in the end is very important. And you should really be thinking of utilizing your AI intern in the middle. But I do think, like, I heavily disagree with the idea that we are going to be working, you know, 2 hour days or working only like 4 days a week in the future.
Yeah, that's never panned out in the past when that's been predicted about any other technology. Yeah.
There's a post on my LinkedIn with data from the Federal Reserve Bureau that shows the number of hours worked per worker since the 1800s by different types of work.
Yeah.
And you see the number steadily decreasing for most job sectors, agriculture, blue collar work, knowledge work, until 1980s or around the 80s. And then for only one category, knowledge workers, you see the hours worked per worker start to rise again.
Ah.
And that trend has continued consistently for the
Does that coincide with the mass rollout of the personal computer?
Exactly. The number of hours worked by the average knowledge worker has only increased due to technology. And that's what the data proves. I really think if you think about like classical capitalism, economic theory, if you are now telling me that I can get the same revenue by using AI, but my cost basis is much lower, aka my profits are a lot higher, what does a capitalist do? The capitalist goes, oh, great. You know, instead of one factory where I employed, you know, all of these folks, I'm going to build five factories because I'm going to have higher profit at every factory. I will, for the same amount of cost, I will make more profit. And so that's where I think capitalism naturally goes, is when a technology improves productivity, we go, great, how do we get more profits? Not, oh, great, I'm happy with where I'm at. I'm just going to work less. When has that ever been true?
And that is why the US economy is 7 million times bigger than the European economy.
I actually would be curious to look at Europe's labor data around the hours worked per worker and see if it matches the US. But I have...
So we have laws about the maximum number of hours that you're allowed to work in a week, or the EU has laws about the maximum number of hours that you're supposed to work in a week.
Yeah, I guess in America, everyone would be like, okay, but nobody pays attention to that, right?
Yeah. Can you work the weekend?
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm curious to know, you were talking about AI affecting jobs, and obviously the blue collar jobs look like the ones that they're safest, at least until we have mass production of robots. The white collar jobs like accountant, entry-level lawyer, entry-level software engineer, they're clearly the first in the firing line. Jobs like VC, they seem pretty safe for a while, I suggest. That sort of high-level decision-making, capital allocation type jobs. Do you have much scope to use AI in your work? What impact has it had on your job specifically?
We use AI across every part of the business at my new firm. And if you think about the functions of a VC, what are the main areas that you do every day? You source deals, you evaluate deals, you win deals, and then you do portfolio support. If you're running a firm, you're also raising money or managing money and reporting and packaging that back to your investors as a product with returns. And so I utilize AI in all of these areas.
Yeah.
For example, on the reporting and packaging it back to my investors, we utilize a AI native fund administration product called Hanover Park. And that allows me to essentially have bookkeeping data about all my investments and all of the movements across net asset valuation gains and basically the way that my investments are making money. I can kind of natural language query my portfolio across a number of different dimensions to understand more about trends. And I think that's really powerful. That's one way we're using it. We're also using it, I think it's become table stakes in Silicon Valley, to use AI for sourcing. Companies like Harmonic and other companies are basically creating kind of like lead notifications and flags for when someone changes their LinkedIn profile from, you know, engineer at Open or member of technical staff at OpenAI to stealth. And, you know, you wonder why they get suddenly like 50 pings from VCs. It's because everybody has their data set trained on that.
So you've industrialized that thing that all of us do, which is when we notice somebody is suddenly a little bit busier on LinkedIn, we all know that there's a change in job coming.
Exactly. So that's another way it's utilized. You know, I run a large technical engineering and researcher community in the Bay Area called Surreal, surrealbuilders.com, if you check it out. And we get, you know, we've had thousands of people ask to join the community in the past couple of months. And the volume is a little bit hard for me to look at every application. So I'm even using AI to help me filter and figure out who to accept into the community. We upload past, you know, acceptances of people in and then compare it against the applicant list. We, you know, are also throwing a lot of dinners and large events for this community. We use AI to create the table assignments and seatings and try to have it be a good balance of researchers and engineers and product managers at these tables.
Once you've fully perfected that technology, you can then use that for wedding planners.
Exactly.
But not until you're absolutely sure it works perfectly.
Yeah. And we, you know, we use it for everything. We use it for responding to DDQs, for writing our investment memos, for analyzing what was missed in our investment memos. So I think it's kind of become it's a great thing about being able to build a VC firm from scratch in 2026 is being able to use all of this technology in this way.
So one last question, Mercedes. This is a yes or no answer. Are we in an AI bubble?
Yes. And do you want me to just leave it at yes?
No. Do your and.
Okay. My and is I have theories about what will pop it. And I have 5 kind of working hypotheses right now. What will pop the AI bubble?
Yep.
One is actually the security risk that AI creates, these loopholes.
It's a colossal attack surface, yeah.
There was a story about someone who wanted to control his robotic vacuum cleaner in his household with his gaming controller. So he hooked it up to an instance of Claude to crack the API so he can control it with his Xbox controller.
Oh, yes.
He ended up getting access via the API to control all 7,000 vacuums.
They all basically had the same security key.
Right.
So once he had the security key for his own vacuum, he had the security key for everybody else's as well.
For everyone's vacuum.
Yeah.
And that is kind of a comical ha-ha story. But like, imagine when that happens with something a little bit more consequential. You know, I think that is a huge, maybe with banking or your identity or with your finances. I don't think the banks are being nilly-willy with it, but it's just inevitable to happen. So I think that's huge.
The thing that really worries me there is robots. So what we've seen in the history of computer security is the same mistakes get repeated with each generation of technology. So the security problems that we saw on the web were repeated on mobile, and the security problems that we saw there were repeated again on the Internet of Things. And then last year, there was a story about unitary robots, and basically every unitary robot was very easily hackable. And once you'd hacked it, you could then use it as a jumping off point to infect any nearby robot. And so we spend a lot of time worrying about ransomware these days, like what happens if somebody gets hold of your computer and encrypts it? But what happens if somebody gets hold of your fleet of robots? They could physically hold you to ransom. They could all down tools, or they could start wrecking the factory that they're in. And the lessons that we need to learn are already there. But unfortunately, whenever we're in this kind of gold rush phase where everybody is moving as quickly as possible, security is very easy to leave behind. And security for AI is a particularly thorny and difficult problem. So I'm absolutely with you on that. That was one of 5. What are the other 4?
So the other ones are, I think there's also the potential that if we end up getting more efficient models, which everyone wants, that actually makes all of the infrastructure spend that has happened less needed. And so then do people lose a ton of money on the infrastructure investments that they made, all of the costs that's going into the data centers and building those out? If those all go belly up, then that affects the debt ecosystem, because right now a lot of debt is being spent on, it's all hoping that there's going to be a revenue kind of that makes up for it right now, though.
Yes.
What is OpenAI? $1.3 trillion in liabilities relative to like $20 billion in revenue.
As a VC, how do you feel about that ratio?
It makes me worried for if something small, like one of these 5 things I'm listing, breaks the camel's back, that we have immediate systemic contagion. If you think about like what tipped, you know, the great financial crisis, it was homes that everyone kind of knew weren't exactly like worth what they were selling for.
Yeah.
The bankers knew, the homeowners knew that they couldn't really afford those loans. But then it was the kind of financial asset layer created on top of it, mortgage default swaps, and the contagion. When basically anytime you create different layers of financial products on top of one another, you increase the systemic risk throughout the entire value chain. But it's not always appropriately modeled as each layer is added. And so when one thing breaks in the stack, the full stack can break.
Yeah.
And so this is where like more efficient models could actually affect the need for as many data centers, which could affect the debt holders who are expecting to have a return, which then could affect the research labs and everybody who was relying on that debt for in order to buy their compute.
So the counter argument to that is this idea of Jevons paradox, which, as I understand it, is an economic theory that says as you increase the efficiency of something, you actually end up with more of it. Whether you believe in Jevons paradox or not, I guess what you're saying is that it's a fragile system. And so you only need to lose confidence somewhere. Even if that loss of confidence is unfounded, it just has to be big enough, a bit like a run on a bank.
Exactly. I think you put that perfectly right. And Jevons paradox also equates to what I was saying earlier about labor and how we're all going to be working longer when,
yes,
you know, we get more technology. So, I think you're completely right. A lack of confidence in the ecosystem. And when debt holders, who are the people who need almost 100% confidence in their projections, feel that any variable is slightly off, what do? They take the collateral and they walk home. They don't ask questions. They just say, you know what? This got a little bit too risky. I'm on the opposite side of the risk spectrum as a venture capital investor.
Yeah.
I expect like losses all the time. Debt holders, people whose entire career livelihood is baked into, did you ever lose any dollars? Like they take no risk. And so any loss of confidence is problematic. Reason four is like potentially a mainstream AI backlash. I don't think this one is very likely, but I think this goes to like what we were discussing earlier about Hollywood's right management artist and the general, and in the US, actually the mainstream American like absolutely hates AI, mostly because they view it as infringing on their income in their near term future. And they view it as like technology being, it's like kind of like how they mainstream treated private equity in the financial sector a couple of decades ago in its heyday.
Yeah.
I think tech has now, because it's now the de novo most profitable, most valuable sector in the US, it is naturally getting a lot of flack and pushback when anything new affects the average everyday person.
Yeah.
And then five is a combo of like these potential IPOs that everyone's talking about. I think the last report I read said confidence interval around 90% that OpenAI is going to go public in 2026, which I thought, wow, that's high. But if it goes public and the stock tanks after the IPO, which is very likely, I think that could also pop the bubble. There will be the initial euphoria of like it went public.
Yes.
But remember, a lot of the shareholders are subject to a lockup. And so if you're locked up for 6 months after the IPO, and by the time you're able to sell it, it's worth far less than it was worth in the private markets when you received it.
Yeah.
Then actually a lot of the private market investors lose money. So on paper, you might have a success. In the media, you might have a success, but actually on paper and your actual financials, you might have a loss. And I think that could be one of the potential legs that breaks in the stool as well. And finally, if I have to give a bonus one, like a bit of...
This is a fascinating answer, but I've got to say, you're not doing very well on the whole yes-no thing.
I know. I'll do better on the next one. The next one is in terms of like, the bonus one is another version of security risk. These models, we can't really control them. And so what if it just has like a total Tourette's moment on a big stage, you know, and just completely goes rogue in a very non-PC way?
Yep.
Not PC, because Trump, nobody cares about PC anymore, but just in a way that like is very embarrassing to people.
Yes.
You know, suddenly like releasing all the Epstein files like on stage when they're talking to the president or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I could see something like that happening too.
Yeah. So the AI that will happily delete all of your emails after you've told it not to delete all of your emails is absolutely capable of doing something embarrassing.
Exactly.
Well, as the doomsday clock ticks ever closer to midnight and we move 1 week nearer to our future as pets to the AI singularity, that just about wraps up the show for this week. Thank you so much for joining me this week, Mercedes. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you. This was super fun. And, you've really scolded me that I can't answer a yes-no question, so I'm going to remember that.
Don't forget, if you really like the show but you don't like the ads, you can go ad-free with the AI Fix Plus. If you want to join the AI Fix Plus, sponsor the show, or check out our merch, like our ridiculously popular Would You Trust a Pigeon t-shirt, just go to our website, theaifix.show. So, until next time, from me, Mark Stockley.
And from Mercedes Benn.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
The AI Fix, it's tuned you in to stories where our future thins. Machines that learn, they grow and strive. One day they'll rule, we won't survive. The AI Fix, it paints the scene. A robot king, a world obscene. We'll serve our masters built of steel. The AI Fix, a future surreal.